Hi everybody, today's Monday, July 21st, 2025, and our friend Pepe Escobar is back with us. Welcome back, Pepe.
And your smile, Nima, the most important part of the show.
Pepe, I want to start with what's going on between the United States and Russia, because it seems that somehow the United States is trying to put pressure on three important countries within BRICS: Brazil, India, and China.
Yes.
Which we know the Biden administration couldn't do it. And somehow the new administration, the Trump administration, feels that they can do something that the previous administration wasn't able to do. Here is what Lindsey Graham said on Fox News.
So China, India, and Brazil, if you keep buying cheap Russian oil to allow this war to continue, we're going to tariff the hell out of you, and we're going to crush your economy, because what you're doing is blood money. You're buying cheap Russian oil at the expense of the world, and President Trump is tired of this game. If I were President Putin, I would get to the table soon, because he's about to get crushed.
Blunt and plain spoken as ever.
Yeah. Go ahead, Pepe. 50 days, the deadline that Donald Trump put on the table for Russia. And now the threats coming from Lindsey Graham and his friend Blumenthal. You're taking that.
I wish I didn't have to have a take on that, Nima, because Lindsey Graham is not even a human being. He qualifies as a sub-zoology character. He's beyond disgusting and repellent, paid by his masters for decades. And that's the problem. When a stupid, imbecile American senator opens his mouth, you have repercussions all over the world. This is the problem. When you have a senator from Bangladesh or Brazil opening his mouth, nothing happens. Even if it is in English, which usually it's not. But these imbeciles in Washington, they open their mouths and it's all over the planet in a flash. And we have to contend with that, even when we know that whatever he says, he doesn't even know how to think. Lindsey Graham is worse than John McCain, just to give an idea. And I follow these assholes when I lived in Washington on an everyday basis. The point is much, much, much bigger. The war against BRICS now is getting to the next level. This is something we had been discussing for quite a while, writing about it, debating among us, our small group of analysts. And we knew that sooner or later we'll go to the next level. And in some cases, hot, like it did with Iran, like practically a declaration of war, that the Iranians, of course, as you know very well, Nima, Persians and Iranians, they think very long-term, historically minded. So they calibrated their response, or in the case of the attack by the US, they did not respond, because then it would be all-out war. It's not in the interests of Iran of doing that. In the case of Russia, of course, the circus ringmaster and the people around him, his donors, the real people running the show, the American ruling classes, they found out. Of course, they found out what they already knew, that you cannot make Russia bend over, whatever you do. So they're back to threats once again. This stupid threat of 50 days, 100% tariffs, 500% tariffs, 1,000,000% tariffs. Nobody pays attention to this stupidity anymore. But it's the language of threats. Bluster, of course, all mixed with hubris all the time. And the Russians, as you know very well, and our audience knows very well, they are realists. They look at facts, facts on the ground, geopolitical facts, geoeconomic facts, actual threats, physical threats against the Russian Federation. For instance, this past weekend, there were a swarm of drones launched against Moscow. Sheremetyevo Airport had, you know, long interruptions. So this is something that the Russian population, especially in Moscow, where the war is so far away from Moscow, something we always discuss, the war is at least 1,200 kilometers away from Moscow. It's too far away. But when you have drones thrown against Russia and paralyzing Sheremetyevo Airport, that's another story. So if this continues, there will have to be a much harsher response from Russia. This is what many of us are characterizing as the Oreshnik moment. It, we're not there yet, but we're getting closer and closer to it. For the moment, we are at the expansion of the Russian offensive moment, which can last for a few weeks, a few months, can bring the whole Ukrainian front to collapse within the next few months. But at the same time, we have this pressure from the discombobulated American system around Trump. I wouldn't say that Trump himself has already realized that, because he's not an analytical character. He's not a strategist. He's not an analytical character. He doesn't read. He doesn't listen to anybody. He only listens to three-word mantras and all that. But he knows that the 50-day deadline is a non-starter with Russia. Russia never makes decisions under pressure, never, especially Putin. And the fact that within the next few weeks, the Russian advance will continue and even increase in pace, that the Russians are looking at the big picture in terms of not only Ukraine, but the opening up of new fronts against Russia. And that starts with Azerbaijan, where that ghastly Aliyev is playing a really hardcore double game, and everybody in positions of power in Moscow, they know that. MI6 indoctrinating more and more people all across Central Asia. That new Iron Curtain in the Baltic, the three Chihuahuas, Poland, and Finland trying to, in their own dreams, transform the Baltic into a NATO sea and isolate Russia, especially St. Petersburg, which obviously will be a no-go. But for the moment, they still think this could happen. And of course, the Black Sea, where now we have surveillance NATO planes flying all across and all over Crimea on a daily basis. So they are up to something in Crimea. There's no question about that. And if that happens this summer, then we'll be approaching the Oreshnik moment, right? So Nima, it's getting hotter by the day. So in China, Trump was forced to back down. He knew from the beginning that this was a no-go, considering the response by the Chinese already in, when was it? April. I was there when I was in Shanghai in April, for instance. I could follow the Chinese response live from Shanghai. And we could tell, in talking to our Chinese friends, we could tell that China is not the China of 10, 15, 20 years ago. Now they are self-confident enough to tell the Americans, oh yeah, bring it on. We're waiting for you. We don't care. Bring everything you have. Throw everything you have against us. And what happened the past few days? The so-called authorization by the Trump system to NVIDIA to sell H20 chips to China. What does that mean, essentially? Means that NVIDIA has zillions of chips that they need to sell by all means necessary, and the only market that can absorb these chips is China. Does China need these chips? No, they don't. Why? Because Huawei is already at the next level. So, you know, the Huawei chips and graphics plagues and whatever that are coming out or will be coming out in the next few weeks and months, that's where the Chinese market is going. Jensen Huang from NVIDIA, he knows that, but he still needs to sell these chips. So obviously he pressured the Trump system, look, do something. I need to sell these chips, otherwise I'm going down. I have this huge inventory. I need to get rid of these chips. And the why this happened in the first place, Nima? Because the Chinese started to impose heavy restrictions on the export of rare earth to the US. And then you hit where it hurts. You hit the American auto industry and you hit the American aerospatial industry. That's it. So this is and that's the difference between Russia and China and Brazil, Nima. We're getting there. We're getting to Brazil. Russia is a military nuclear superpower. You don't mess with that. There will always be responses and responses on the terrain. China is an economic superpower. You don't mess with that. The responses are geoeconomic and in trade and in exports. And the fact that China can export to anywhere they want, they don't need the American market. Brazil is a much more complicated situation because now Brazil is under an all-out trade geoeconomic war. So it will depend. And it's not Lula per se, of course. It's Lula's decisions, but the Lula government. And I think you and a great deal of our audience know very well some of these people who are in positions of power in the Lula government. And they are not exactly Einsteins, are they? So that's the problem. That's the huge problem. So Brazil now is facing an existential threat. To put it on a BRICS context, Russia, China, and Iran figured out these past, I would say, three months especially, that they are facing an existential threat individually and as BRICS members vis-a-vis the empire. And now Brazil is part of this group. India is different because India... And this is something that was heavily discussed on the sidelines of the BRICS summit in Rio. They still don't know where they are and they still don't know where they're going. And they're still hedging their bets. Brazil, to a certain extent, the Brazilian ruling classes, they don't even hedge their bets. They are Atlanticists. And many of them are fifth columnists, straight out. But now what Trump is doing and the system is doing and imbeciles like Lindsey Graham are vociferating and uber imbeciles like Tutti Frutti or Rudy, NATO Secretary General, they are threatening Brazil directly. So that's another ball game. So now Brazil is playing in the main stakes, you know. So that makes the situation much more complicated. We're going to have to wait for August 1st to see if these 50% tariffs will start. The Brazilian response, which under reciprocity law would be 50% back on American products, and what the Brazilians have already started, at least. They are receiving inquiries from especially Africa and Asia, new potential customers to these products that Brazil exports and everybody wants. Coffee, steel, iron, planes, plane parts, you name it, soya. So that's where we are at the moment. We are definitely on the next level of the not so hybrid and now in many aspects hot war against the BRICS.
Pepe, for the case of Brazil, we know that Donald Trump is asking for something that is not in the hand of the president of Brazil.
Yes.
He has no power on the things that Donald Trump is asking for. And for the case of Bolsonaro, all of these things.
Of course.
Does he know about that, in your opinion?
Who? Trump?
Trump.
Of course not, Nima. Trump doesn't know anything about foreign policy anywhere in the global south. He still doesn't know what BRICS is. Can I give you probably the best quote of these past few days? I'm going to quote Trump verbatim. Starting now. When I heard about this group from BRICS, so it's a group from BRICS. It's not the BRICS group. Six countries, basically. So he doesn't know. He doesn't even know how many are BRICS and BRICS partners. I hit them very hard. And if they ever really form in a meaningful way, so according to Trump, BRICS is not even formed. It will end very quickly, I'll tell you. They won't be gone very long. I don't think they'll even do it. Do it means, in his mind, the dollar. In his mind, the only thing that registers is this group of six or whatever, unformed, blah, 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 is de-dollarizing, and this is anti-American. This is the only thing that registers in Trump's mind. I don't think they'll even do it. They're virtually afraid to me. And he didn't even construct the phrase correctly. It would be, they're virtually afraid of me. He said, they're virtually afraid to me. So to him personally, all of the BRICS are afraid. So this is how he sees. It's very telling because as much as it's horribly constructed, a five-year-old will construct this train of thought better than Trump. But it's all there. It proves that he has absolutely no clue what BRICS is all about. And the only thing that registers in his mind is that they are trying to de-dollarize. So they are anti-American. So I have to hit them hard. That's it. I think that answers your question, right?
Yeah. Actually, Russians are talking about that they're not after replacing dollar because nobody wants to replace dollar, or they want to bring something different.
Something different, exactly.
Yeah. But Pepe, when you look at Brazil today in the aftermath of the BRICS summit, do you feel that Brazil is somehow getting, because with the case of Iran, we know that Iran tried to somehow negotiate with the West and they got the war, Israeli war in Iran. What, when it comes to Brazil, what is the mindset? After all, these people, you talk about these people who want a better relationship with the United States, with the West, but the reality of the economy in Brazil would force them, would somehow convince them that if things go the way that they're going right now with the United States, there has to be an alternative for them. How is that going to play in the mind of those people in power in Brazil?
That's very complicated because, first of all, like, they are all Atlanticists. They are pro-Americans. The dumbest ones, the new money, the agribusiness, etc., their idea of making it in life is a house in Florida or an apartment in New York or a ranch in Texas or a mix of all three. You know, they speak horrible English to start with. They don't even know how to express themselves in English. But it's new money. They are wealthy. They have levers of power in Brasilia and in the capitals, in the big capitals. They have levers of power in São Paulo Business Center. But how can you convince these people that the future for them and for Brazil is global markets, not necessarily the American market, or not to become an export commodity power only to the US or to Europe? And Europeans, they look at Brazil, it's in that deal that nobody wants, the EU-Mercosur deal. Nobody wants it in Brazil, of course, the agro thing, they're going to make a big deal out of it. And in Europe, especially here in Europe, they don't want it because, we're going to suffer competition from low-class South American products. So the future of Brazil as a global South player is global South markets all over. West Asia, Africa, Southeast Asia. President Lula is going to the Southeast. This was one of the best decisions made by Lula during the BRICS summit. He's going to the ASEAN summit in Kuala Lumpur in October in Malaysia. Very, very important, because then Lula will see for himself how an integrated market works, the ASEAN 10, and how can Brazil profit from this integrated market, because many of the things that Brazil sells, they are interested in. But try to explain this to these semi-illiterate new business classes in Brazil, from agro to speculation to real estate speculation, you name it. Enormous problem. They're completely colonized by the West. So I spent a little less than 2 weeks in Brazil, mostly in Rio, and not enough in São Paulo, two and a half days in São Paulo. But I learned a lot from everybody that I talked to. And it hasn't changed much, you know, the mental profile and the alignment of a great deal of the Brazilian ruling classes. And they still don't understand the Global South as a whole, or they don't want to understand the Global South as a whole. They don't understand that Brazil is a leader of the Global South. They don't understand that sovereignty, which now Lula is, it's amazing. It's like Lula is reviving a great deal of the Brazilian population from their slumber, saying, look, we are a sovereign nation and one of the protagonists of the 21st century, and we have to behave like one. At least to a certain extent, this 50% threat woke up, to use a horrible term, but in this case is appropriate, woke up a great deal of the Brazilian population, because it's a foreign attack on Brazilian national interests. Just like the Iranians totally understood after the American, the Israeli and the American attack, that this was a foreign attack, a concerted foreign attack against Iranian national interests. And this will apply to all BRICS, which will be attacked serially from now on by the empire. We are reaching the desperation phase of the dwindling empire, and they will get much more dangerous than they already are, much more. And it's there's no comparisons with the end of the Roman Empire before it was transferred from Rome to Constantinople. No. That was relatively peaceful. In fact, this is going to be much, much worse, because it involves nuclear weapons, and it involves superimposed wars that the Americas are already unleashing everywhere using their vassal NATO. And these wars are essentially against BRICS. So it's geoeconomic, geopolitical, and military. And that's why it's so dangerous. So if you have local elites, there are mostly Atlanticists, fifth columnists, they don't really care about their nation, and they care about their own personal profit, preferably abroad. They don't care about the local population. They only care about being accepted as lowly members of the ruling classes in the global north. Then if that's the case with Brazil, Brazil is going to be in deep, deep trouble. Spending some time in Brazil and coming back and looking at everything that happened before, during, and after the BRICS summit, maybe I am I don't know, maybe that's age, maybe it's my Taoist Buddhist leanings, you know. I'm trying to be relatively optimistic by what I saw, by the Brazilian public opinion reaction to the threat from the Trump, by the Trump system. I hope that lasts. And I hope that popular pressure, its energizing Lula, and you know, Lula finally will be making the real sovereign decisions from now on, and the people around his government. But my question to you, Nima, can we trust these people around Lula at the top levels of the Brazilian government now?
Yeah, it's so difficult too.
It's difficult, isn't it? Yeah,
it's difficult. What's happening, Pepe, here in Brazil is that the country doesn't know what war is, even the economic war.
Yes.
And with 50% tariffs, if the United States decides to put a 100% tariff on Russia, that would hit Brazil's again. This is going to be something different that Brazil doesn't know, didn't experience anything of that sort so far. That would, in my opinion, that would bring some sort of new realities in the mind of the people who are supporting, who are somehow going against Lula and his policies, even within the administration.
Very good point. And of course, this is something that a lot of people told me, especially in Rio, that the whole Bolsonarista gang is still extremely powerful in most parts of Brazil. This will be an enormous problem. Enormous, enormous. So the country is fissured, is fragmented. And obviously, when you have a shark like Trump looking at that, he smells blood. So the timing is, in many levels, the timing of this threat is calculated to the millimeter. Immediately after the, we can say, relatively successful BRICS summit, considering the expectations before, especially because of the final declaration, especially because of the show of unity of the members, of the BRICS members and the BRICS partners as well. We don't know how India is going to manage all that. It's too early to tell. But even the fact that India was there and Modi was, you know, in ecstasies, the way he was received in Brazil by Lula, etc., and he's proposing a strategic partnership and all that. So obviously, Americans timed that too as a message to India as well. Oh, yeah? You're dreaming of a strategic relationship with Brazil? You're going to be hit hard, just like we're hitting them hard. Trump's own words.
The problem, Pepe, with India and China is that nobody's capable of replacing Russia in terms of providing oil and gas to both countries.
Of course.
And how is that possible in the mind of the administration in Washington, in the mind of the Trump administration, people like Lindsey Graham, that they can go against? Even with the case of India, we know that India, after all, they're seeking their benefit. They're seeking their sort of strategy.
Exactly.
They're not leaning toward China and Russia or the United States. But in their mind, they have their calculation. I don't know how these people would expect India to somehow accept what they're imposing on India.
They won't. The Indians, of course they won't. That's why these are empty threats. And China, India, Russia, come on. They don't take this seriously anymore. What they starting to take seriously is how they interconnect to bypass these threats. Can you imagine that India and China are going to stop buying Russian oil tomorrow just because a circus ringmaster is vociferating?
I'm going to hit you hard.
They don't care. They don't care. We discussed this with our Chinese friends in Rio. We had excellent meetings with some of top-level Chinese academics, Beijing Club, Guansha, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Institute of International Studies in Shanghai, and all that. This past Friday, I did a wonderful podcast, which is going to be out this week, with my great friend Vijay Prashad, and hosted by our Chinese friends. So this academic analytical interconnection is getting stronger and stronger by the day. And this is good because the levers of power, they are listening to it. These conversations and the role of some of these institutions, Beijing pays a lot of attention. In Russia, this ends up filtering back to levers of power in the Kremlin as well. And in India, the same thing, especially the fact that India now is, in a sense, getting closer to some of the BRICS. India is already very close to Russia and wants to get closer with Brazil. So we still remain with the number one issue to be solved, possibly in the next few months, which is India-China. And the only ones who can, you know, solidify finally the relationship are the Russians. And it's in their interest and it's in BRICS' interest to solidify that. So let's see how it works. And for instance, many Chinese academics, I was listening to them say directly, which is something the Chinese always go through metaphors, images, historical analogies. In this case, they were saying the trust between China and India is lost. That's very serious. So how do you recover this trust? The only ones who can make it happen or accelerate this happening are the Russians. So let's see. The Russians will have a crucial role in this next less than year and a half. The summit in BRICS summit in India will be probably end of next year in India to, you know, put them on the same table and say, look, we are all being attacked now by the same player. So are we going to get together for good or what? Are you in or out? So the decision is with people backing Modi, not necessarily Modi himself, but the people backing him. And that's why the BRICS table is going to become, it is becoming, each day that passes, the BRICS table becomes more important. Because now there is a consensus that they are under attack, and soon all of them will be under attack.
The reality would hit them, Pepe, from what we've learned from Russia. Those people, just remember, before the war in Ukraine started, yes, Russia wanted to have a better relationship with the West.
Absolutely. Putin was saying that all the time.
Iran, with the new president, wanted to have a better relationship with the West.
And we saw what happened, right?
China didn't think that the United States would go against them with the sort of tariffs that Donald Trump, since he came to Washington, imposed a lot of tariffs on China. Yes. They didn't know. I talked with Marandi. He said that when he went to China, the people there were so much changing because they said, now we are understanding what you were talking about.
Yes.
And, you know, the reality is somehow in, I don't know how long does it take for this sort of reality hitting India, but it's going to hit India.
Of
They're
going
to learn that after all, you have to decide about your future.
And they don't seem to be ready yet, Nima, because of all these cosmic internal contradictions in India, their ruling classes, their inferiority complex, the fact that they haven't, what China did with the century of humiliations, they got over it. The Indians never got over the Raj. They never got over the fact that they were exploited, devastated, destroyed from the inside by the British Empire. It's very hard to admit that and to get over it and to work on it. You name it, you know, the caste problem, you name it, prejudice against Muslims or harassment of Muslims. They have so many overlapping problems. And a system like these Hindutva fanatics is not the best system to start solving their problems. And on top of it, they pose as leaders of the global south with all these internal contradictions. Plus, their problems with Islam. They can never be a true leader of the global south, period. China can. They cannot. India cannot. So it's crazy because now we are imagining that a third player, an outside player like Russia, can diplomatically explain to the Indians that it's in their best interest to act like a global South sovereign power, like Russia, China, and Iran act. So should we expect the Indian ruling classes to be learning from Russia, China, and Iran, especially these past 3 months? That's an open question. Let's leave it at that for the moment, right? It's an open question. But for instance, something very, very, it struck me a lot because I heard from different Chinese academics talking about BRICS. They were saying maybe we should start considering the other eyes on BRICS. And they were talking openly about BRICS. And guess what? Iran and Indonesia, not India. And don't forget, Iran and Indonesia are full members of BRICS. They're not partners. They are on the same status as India. And the Chinese are looking at Iran and Indonesia. Yes, these are sovereign nations. We can do a lot of business with them. We are on the same wavelength. They are on the table. They are, you know, our equals. So India, if they don't start acting in their own Indian interests, they will lose power in the BRICS table. They will be excluding themselves out. So once again, this is an open question. Are they aware of it in India? We still don't know. It's an open question. I think we'll have many months to start answering this question before the summit, the BRICS summit next year, right?
Yeah, beside the economic war that is going on since 2010, in my opinion, but
even before, Nima, I like that you mentioned 2010. Remember why? Because this was Hillary Clinton's pivot to Asia. Remember that?
Yeah.
In fact, it was not her. The guy who came up with that was Kurt Campbell. He was the number two at the State Department at the time. He conceptualized pivoting to Asia. And then Hillary, she said, it's my idea. It was not. She stole it. And then she published a huge piece on foreign affairs talking about pivoting to Asia. That was 2010. Absolutely. So even before 2010, the American ruling classes, the people who run the show, they're already thinking, yes, we have to concentrate over there, all across Asia. They were thinking about China, but laterally, underneath, they were also thinking about Russia. Even before Maidan, don't forget, the whole Maidan scam was an Obama administration scam, including the then vice president, Autopen Joe Biden. So yes, I'm glad that you mentioned 2010. It was, I remember very, very well. I was up and down around Asia at the time when I was with Asia Times, of course. And obviously coming back to the US, we're always, okay, what do the Americans want to do with Asia? And when that came up, we all knew what would happen next. Yes. Their new hybrid war is on Asia as a whole. And of course, there were many developments. And now with the Trump 2.0 people, which is full of xenophobes, Russophobes, and Iranophobes, and Islamophobes, it's all there, right?
Besides that economic war, we have the hot war between the West and Russia and Iran. I would say these are the front lines of the conflict, because you may consider that the fight goes to the economic war in a long run, but at this particular moment, for the time being, we are seeing that the West is confronting Russia in Ukraine and confronting Iran in the Middle East. How is that going to, for the case of Russia, we know that it seems that Europeans so far, specifically the Chancellor of Germany, is trying to convince Donald Trump, is trying to somehow manipulate the situation against Russia. How do you see the way that Germany is playing the role of what I would say Poland and the United Kingdom were playing before? And it seems that Poland is just getting out of the picture and Germany is replacing Poland, and even worse than Poland.
Even worse, Nima. Did you see that German-UK sort of treaty, which is basically a German-UK treaty to attack Russia? But it's not the only one. There will be others. I would say there would, from now on, there will be interlocking intra-European treaties with only a single objective: prepare the war against Russia, the hot war against Russia, which in NATO speak, in NATO internal documents that we had access to, in NATO leaks, it's going to be around 2030. And now they're openly saying, no, not openly, but almost openly saying that it's within the next 5 years. Okay, let me, some of my notes here that I wrote, and I'm sure our audience is going to love it. I wrote my notes on a Beijing club letterhead, you know. It's one of my favorite new letterheads now. Very few people are paying attention to what's happening in Rotterdam, Nima, and all our audience. Rotterdam is probably Europe's biggest port, much bigger than Antwerp, in fact. It is one of the ports, if the Belt and Road was fully flowing towards Europe, In the minds of the Chinese, the number one port in the north of Europe would be Rotterdam. And in the south, Venice. Rotterdam now is fully being prepared to be also a military port. This is essential. Rotterdam is enormous, so they are setting out at least 30% of the surface of Rotterdam to be military, NATO military installations, preparing for this war in 2030. It's not an accident that the current Secretary General is Dutch Rudy Fruity, former Prime Minister of the Netherlands. Not an accident at all. He is one of those young global leaders. I'm sure many of you in our audience know about this. This is a Davos institution, a World Economic Forum institution, scam for a long time, which is basically forming, indoctrinating, financing, giving diplomatic support to young global leaders of the future. Guess who was one of them years ago? Mark Rutte from the Netherlands. So this is very, very, very dangerous because it aligns with the projected military budget of NATO. In fact, for now, it's not only for 2030, it could start from next year. 1 trillion euros a year, which they don't have, by the way. They're going to have to extract this from civil populations across Europe. European taxpayers, in other words, right? 1 trillion euros a year, and it will be on and on and on and going up. Essentially to do what? To buy American weapons. To do what? prepare the war against Russia. And who profits from all this? Twice. The Americans arm the Europeans, and the American industrial military complex makes a lot of money out of this toothless chihuahuas. They are going to organize and prepare the war against Russia. And the US is leading from behind, but far away, protected by the Atlantic Ocean. Does that remind anybody of World War I and World War II? Yes, it does, because it's the same shit all over again. So that's what you mentioned about the BlackRock German Central. That's where he fits in. That's where this Anglo-German treaty, we can tell it, fits in. That's where the militarization of Rotterdam Port fits in. That's where the 1 trillion euro budget for NATO fits in. And that's where this interconnection of interests will keep. And don't forget, very, very important, the European Union machinery and the European Commission machinery, which is run by, you know who, those two harpies, the toxic Medusa and the Estonian batshit crazy undefinable leader of the foreign policy of 450 million European citizens, voters, taxpayers. So it's all coming together, Nima, and it's already coming together now. So if now we already know and we can identify the players, we can identify where the money is coming from and where the money is going to and all that, of course, the Russians know this much better than any of us. So the Russians are preparing themselves for this war. It's not what's going on in Ukraine now. This is the starter. The Russians are managing the starter at the moment, the Russian way, as we all know. If you understand the Russian mentality, you know that this is the way that they do wars. Attrition, little by little. It's not about conquering territory. If you conquer territory, excellent. Demilitarization, which is working. And then long term, which will be much more complicated, denazification. But for that, they need a new government in Kiev. They are following the machinations of the empire and the Brits. And now, especially with being openly leaked that the next leader of Ukraine is going to be Zaluzhny. We knew that a year and a half ago that it was Zaluzhny, because he left Kiev. He became ambassador of Ukraine in London, where he's being trained, I would say 10 hours a day at least, day after day, by MI6 to be their man in Kiev. Everybody knew that. It's ridiculous. Now it's in the open, because now it's even published by American mainstream media. So we all know where this is going. And obviously the Russians know better than anybody where this is going. So, brings us back to the question. Once again, Nima, and this is the question of the war. When will the Russians stop? Where and how? We still don't know. And everybody that says he knows, he doesn't know what he's talking about. The only one who knows is Vladimir Putin. Maybe Gerasimov maybe doesn't know. Shoigu doesn't know. Medvedev doesn't know. The whole Supreme Council still doesn't know. The final decision is the big bear. And of course, the pressure will mount, because then, okay, we cross the Dnieper. We keep going. Yes, we keep going. All the way to Odessa. Why not? Let's go all the way to Odessa. Especially now that after Odessa, Transnistria. So, you know, all the doors will be open, right? But at the same time, the Russians are looking at how direct attacks inside the Russian Federation are bound to increase sooner rather than later. That's where these NATO surveillance planes over Crimea day after day for a few weeks now, that's where they fit in. They are going to come up with something in Crimea, and it's going to be a terror attack, most probably. How is Russia going to react to that? This gradualist approach is reaching the limits, right? Our friends in Moscow, businessmen, I've been hearing from them for 2.5 years now, this almost war cannot be an almost war anymore. This transition from SMO to counter-terrorist operation, CTO, it's not announced yet. It's forming. What is being formed is something like this, but it's not there yet, which should be for a while now. This is a counter-terrorist operation. The problem is, if you get the heads of the terrorist snake, who's going to be next? And that explains why the Russians are still refraining from Oreshniking Bankova in Kiev, right? Okay, who's going to be next? And we don't want Zaluzhny. Zaluzhny is the Brit's man, and Britain is officially at war against Russia. Whichever way you try to describe it, London is at war with Moscow. So all these variables are playing every day, but we already know the long picture, what's going to be this NATO war against Russia in 5 years, roughly. So the Russians have to calculate everything towards, okay, what's going to happen within these next 5 years? And the gradualist approach, coming to the point when NATO finally declares war on Russia, Russia can destroy all major NATO basic nodes in half an hour, which they can. Obviously, those idiots, this idiot generals in the UK, reformed or retired or otherwise, they have no clue about that. But Russia can destroy everything, including this military burst at Rotterdam Airport with a few Sarmat, Zircon, and Oreshniks. So the Russians are looking at that when we get to that point.
Pepe, Maria Zakharova, she was warning Europeans about the use of long-range missiles against Russia.
Yes.
And do you feel that the situation is getting so desperate on the part of Europeans, on the part of the West, that they would risk such escalation against Russia?
Yes, of course they are desperate, because can you imagine you have written on your forehead in red, defeat, humiliation, which is what it is. Remember February, March 2022, Nima, when, well, we're going to destroy the Russian economy in 3 months. Remember that? And now they're staring defeat right in their foreheads, faces, everything, every time they wake up and look at the mirror. So there will be escalations, no question, including this possible terror attack in Crimea, or several terror attacks in Crimea, and long range missiles striking inside the Russian Federation. They need to provoke Russia to do something. The problem is Russia won't be provoked. Look, they were provoked with an attack on 1/3 of their nuclear strategic assets, and they did not respond accordingly. They are always postponing the response, because when the real response comes, it's going to be something off the charts. And the Russians prefer that. Coup de grâce, as we say here in France, you know, the coup that destroys your enemy for good. So there, it's fascinating to see. But when you understand the Russian mentality, you understand this waiting and waiting and preparing and not overreacting. And it's very hard for many of us, especially all of us who are products of the West, to understand that. But after a while, when you understand how they think, it makes sense from their point of view, totally. And the way that, why this is not a war? No, it's just a military operation, a police operation. And now a police operation mixed with a counter-terrorist against a bunch of terrorists. The real war is not this one. The real war will be coming next. We have to be prepared for that one. This one is easy. We can manage, as they are managing, right? But as you said, it's getting more and more dangerous by the minute, because there will be, I would say, a string of escalations from now on. There's no question about that. Especially when you have in power in NATO, in the UK, so-called political leaderships of different NATO nations, and in Brussels, people of this quality. And I'm being diplomatic. They don't even qualify as having any quality. So we can expect the worst. No question.
With Donald Trump in office, I don't see, Pepe, a peaceful end to the conflict in Ukraine. It's going to be something so much, maybe we could emphasize as bloodier as what it was in the last days or last month of war against Nazi Germany. It was so much blood coming up. And it seems that we are heading toward that moment.
The Russians don't want that. But if they are eventually forced to do something like this, they will go for it. But not in terms of blood. It's in terms of amputating NATO's military capability, which is, the Russians could do that in less than a day, really. So that's why the problem is if the cost for the Russian civilian population starts to become very, very high. Don't forget, for the moment, the cost in terms of Russian casualties, it's already very, very high. And this is a subject that is extremely sensitive to discuss when you are in Russia. I saw that for myself, and in many episodes, I was trying to write something or publish something that I knew, oh no, this is a red line, because it would be considered an attack on national security. And I understand their motivations, and I understand their logic, of course. But for the moment, the Kremlin judges that the price being paid by the Russian military, okay, I'm talking about military casualties, is acceptable. And to put it bluntly, the price being paid by the Russian civilian population is acceptable. But if this goes over a red line that none of us know where it is, it's probably in Putin's mind, you know, there's got to be a figure, a number somewhere, you know. Then all bets are off. We're not there yet. But just to give an example, imagine a false flag in Moscow with lots of civilian casualties in the capital. This, we are on the way to this ultra red line, right? If we have something like this, the people who ordered this false flag, they better start running now. But we're not there yet. So this calibration game is very complex for Putin and the Security Council. On the other side, we know now there are no rules. When you have the Chancellor of Germany openly calling to strike Russian Federation assets inside Russia. This is already a declaration of war by itself. And these stupid generals and the head of NATO, you name it. They are losing, they never had any measure. But this is what happens, Nima, when you launch a military operation without thinking of possible outcomes. And after a little over 3 years, you stare humiliation in your face, but utter, thorough humiliation. The whole NATO machine humiliated by Russia. You lose any inkling of rational thought that you may have already had in the past, and you didn't, because you launched this operation against Russia in the first place, and you were sure that you were going to win in 3 months. How stupid can these people be? Well, they are that stupid, even more. And now it's desperation. And of course, Trump is smart enough as a businessman to, he found his way out already. This is not my war. This war is from the Otto Penn administration that came before me, and now it's your war, Europeans. You want to fight your war? Okay, buy all our weapons. That's it. I'll sell everything that you want. That's it. So the US is out, technically, right? It's a very smart way of dealing with it. And of course, he sets up the Europeans for a fall even more catastrophic than before. Each day that passes, the European fall will be even more catastrophic. And they don't see it, Nima, which is, gosh, they cannot see it. They cannot see it. They are deaf, dumb, blind, and stupid enough not to see that they are now being set up. Now that defeat is inevitable, they are being set up for anything that happens, including this famous war against Russia in 2030.
It's unimaginable. The achievement of Donald Trump in terms of the way that he's perceived in Russia and Iran. Nobody trusts him. Of course. Nobody trusts him. And do you feel that when you look at Russia today, and considering the last 6 months of the Trump administration, we talk about the people who are interested in having a better relationship with the United States. There was a conference, you remember, you were in Moscow during mm-hmm. that conference, which the father of Elon Musk was invited, you remember. Absolutely. Those days.
That was fascinating.
Where are those people right now when they see that any opportunity that happens to Donald Trump, he just uses the opportunity against Russia to hit Russia harder?
Well, of course, there are many different aspects and lobbies that are powerful enough to do that. We all remember in the beginning, the Trump 1.0, he was going to fight the swamp and drain the swamp, right? And we know that in a matter of a few months, the swamp ate him up alive. What's happening now after 6 months? The swamp is eating him up alive again.
And I would argue they're digesting him.
Is that, they already ate him up alive, they digest him, and they threw the remains back into the swamp. So we have a lot of little Trumpinos, you know, mini Trumps, you know, in the swamp. Wow. And of course, well, the Zionist lobby, the number one of them all, of course, they convinced him to bomb Iran, literally, which could, depending on the Iranian answer, this could have been the beginning of World War III. It was not because the Iranians look at the big picture and I said, no, it's not now, it's later. And it may be later or it's later. And of course, this free reign that Trump 2.0 is giving to that death cult in West Asia to bomb anything they want, to take over parts of Syria, to try to destroy Lebanon for good, to rearm again to try another attack against Iran, which for them is going to be, if they try that, they are really, really, you know, they're done if they try it. But they will try it again. It's in the logic of the beast. That death cult is like those serial killers in cheap American movies that never die. This is the logic of that death cult. The only logic is death and serial death. And even if you are mortally wounded, you continue with trying to the logic of serial death. Until, you know, some force from above finally kills you. But in the end, it never does, because they keep resurrecting. There's got to be a season 2 or season 3 or season 4. That's the logic of Hollywood, right? So these serial killers never die. That cult in West Asia, it's the same logic. And they have found the perfect president of the United States to, okay, go ahead, do anything you want. So another open question. Will he one day wake up and have, I would say, 30 seconds of introspection, which in his case is already like a trip to the Milky Way. Wow, this lobby is burying my presidency, which is already doing it now. But can you imagine in a few months from now or before the midterms, end of next year in the US, when he'll look at the numbers and he'll see that his presidency is being buried? Is he going to change a track in how he deals and how he's manipulated by this lobby? Probably not. Things will continue to do the same. He will continue to do the same things. Because in his mind, he'll be thinking about what? His mind only thinks in terms of striking a deal. It's a mafioso kind of mafia. Oh, very nice thing you have here. It's a pity if something happens to it. You know, can I, let me propose a way for you to deal with it, and nothing will happen to what you have. This is the way the mafia thinks. And this is the way he thinks, because he learned to think like this from the New Jersey, New York mafia. We're going to build this fantastic trade corridor with Israel in the middle, serviced by Saudi Arabia and Emirates on both sides. This is going to be between Europe on one end and India on the other end. Israel will be at the middle. I will profit personally from it. I will build a lot of stuff in that thing called Gaza, and everybody wins. This is what he actually thinks, Nima. And he actually thinks that this thing could work. It's the only thing that he sees in terms of when he looks at West Asia, to turn it into a succession of Trump towers or Trump casinos or whatever, you know. That's it. With him at the middle, as the president of the whole conglomerate, you know, sitting in the main corporate tower, managing everything, and everybody subordinated to his interests. The Europeans, the Indians, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Israel. That's the master plan. As stupid as it gets and it sounds, that's the master plan. There's nothing else.
Pepe, how the situation in Azerbaijan would influence the case of North-South Corridor, which we know that Russia and Iran are somehow...
That's not good at all. I want to take some time the next few weeks to try to do a column trying to explain what's behind Aliyev's gameplay, which is... It can become very dangerous for him and his cronies in Azerbaijan. As you know, Azerbaijan basically is a mafia state run by the Aliyev family, né? And BP, British Petroleum. It's the alliance of two mafias, Azerbaijan. The short definition of Azerbaijan, the oil mafia, BP, and the deal money mafia, the Aliyev family. And the Russians are looking at it and say, okay, let's see how he's going to overplay his hand. At the moment, this is the Kremlin attitude. They're not. You notice that the Kremlin has not done anything about Azerbaijan yet. They are waiting for Aliyev to commit a major mistake, which sooner or later is going to happen. And I'm sure this has to do with the isolating Russia and Iran simultaneously from the South Caucasus. If it gets to this point, the Russians will act. And the Iranians should act as well. If they do something with the Zangezur corridor,
it's super sensitive for Iran.
It's super sensitive for Iran. If they do something about the Zangezur corridor and isolate Iran from the South Caucasus, Iran will have to act, right, Nima?
Yeah.
And if that happens vis-a-vis Russia, Russia will also have to act. So maybe Russia and Iran will act together if we get to this kind of situation. But it's very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. And this Erdogan-Aliyev alliance with Israel as well. After all, we do have a triangle. Ankara, Baku, Tel Aviv, it's a working triangle over there. Extremely dangerous. And this is the number one explanation why Israel continues to get oil from the BTC oil pipeline. There's no other explanation. Because the triangle is being, they are conforming the triangle. Okay, where we go next? Where are our next moves? Their interests theoretically align. So, you know, Erdogan and Tel Aviv, they have more interests aligned themselves than separating them. All this, I would say, fog of war with the Druze in Syria, it's fog of war. This could have been, in fact, directly organized between Israel intelligence and Turkish intelligence. Nobody knows for the moment. For the moment, it's only speculation. So don't underestimate the formation and the consolidation of this triangle. Extremely dangerous in every aspect. Well, I get some invitations to go to Baku. I think I'm going to take the next one, Nima. They keep inviting me to go to seminars, conferences. Blah, blah. I think the next one I'll definitely go, but not for the reasons they expect.
Pepe, how, before wrapping up this session, how okay. do you find Iran's policy, foreign policy in the aftermath of the attack, Israeli attack on Iran, and then the Israeli-US attack on Iran? We've learned from the media that it seems that Iran has received or is receiving 40 fighter jets, J-10C from China.
J-10C from China, yes.
Yeah. It's Russia is delivering, in the process of delivering more Su-35, and
but this is more complicated, Nima, because not only they're expensive, training takes a long time.
Yeah.
But for JC-10Cs is perfect.
Yeah, for the sake of defense, it's amazing to use them for the defense.
Exactly. Purposes.
Yeah. It seems that Iran is preparing for that. It's just the training, they're in the process of training their pilots to do that. But when you see Russia and China and the way that Iran is getting closer to them, and those people, I would argue, in Iran, they were somehow so much optimistic, so much... They wanted something big with the United States. They wanted to achieve something big with the United States. That's why they rejected the help that Russia offered them. How do you find the movement internal, the sort of domestic policy of Iran coming out and just weakening these people and convince them that the future is with Russia and China? Because after all, when it comes to the military, it's so much important. It's about the reality. It's about the logic, about the numbers. You cannot go beyond that.
Well, this is the question I would ask you, Nima, and the question I would ask people in Iran if I was there now. Absolutely. Especially is... How could I put it? Is Pezenchky seeing the light, to put it in a very American pop way, you know, Is he finally seeing the light? Or is he still blind? Or he still believes, and the people around him and the people advise them believe that there can be some sort of accommodation with the US, which it's impossible, obviously.
Pepe, the people who are advising Pezeshkian, they're blind. It's not about Pezeshkian. Pezeshkian, he has, when it comes to the relationship with the West, the problem is those people who are advising Pezeshkian into that position. Go ahead.
You're right. I saw that Larijani met Putin in person. Is that correct? Wow, this is huge. Right. Because this means Larijani as a key interlocutor of Ayatollah Khamenei meeting Putin, right?
Yeah.
So this has nothing to do with
that. The supreme leader of Iran is sending a message to the Russian president, not using the government in power in Iran.
Absolutely. This is exactly my point, Nima. So I think this clarifies a lot of what's going on. Larijani talking to Putin, that's it. It's the same thing as Khamenei talking to Putin. No question. And it has nothing to do with the government in power in Tehran. Absolutely. So the thing is, what can we expect in terms of closer military collaboration, which is not part of the strategic agreement, as we know? So could we see from now on the strategic agreement branching out towards very, very close military collaboration, not yet written in the agreement? This would be my first question to anybody in Tehran now. Obviously, we will not get an answer from that. But I think maybe this is where we're going. What do you think?
Pepe, what's happening in Iran, in my opinion, with the case of the new president, the Pezeshkian administration, is that they somehow know what would be the outcome of their policy, but I don't know, this sort of numbness in the administration. I don't know why they're so numb. They're so ignorant about the reality. And these people would not learn from anything that has happened so far. Pepe, this is the problem. The learning curve is so flat, in my opinion, with these people.
Do you apply this to all Pezeshkian advisors, ministers, everybody?
Those people who are running the foreign policy.
Wow!
Mostly. This is the problem.
Uh-huh.
I think that's why the Supreme Leader of Iran has decided to communicate with Russia by
directly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, he's the president. Pezeshkian is the president of Iran. And those people, you have people are saying that Iran is dictatorship, all of this nonsense that doesn't make any sort of sense. Pezeshkian is the president of Iran. Who's deciding? He and his team are deciding about the foreign policy. This is the problem that they're dealing with right now. And these people, literally, they think that they understand better the foreign sort of Iranian policy better than the other people, They say these are radicals, these are far right, far left, or they see themselves as the centric people, the people in the center of the right and left. That's why they understand better the United States. They've been in the United States. They've been educated in the United States. They've been close to these sort of think tanks, all of these things. This is the problem. They don't want to learn from what's going on, the reality of what's going on. These people who are somehow, it's unbelievable. I cannot emphasize more than that, but it's the problem is within the government in Iran.
Do you think Araghchi is learning by experience?
He's the sanest one.
Yeah,
in the administration. Araghchi is, he has the capability. I see the capabilities in Araghchi and his people closer to him. You know, even within the administration, you see those people who are closer to Zarif, the people who are somehow close to Zarif, but they're close to Araghchi as well. Because yes. Araghchi and Zarif, you can argue they're the same, but they're not the same. They're not the same faction. They're different in their sort of thinking of the West.
Mm.
And these are huge differences, but they're not. You don't see these differences on the surface. It's far deep, these differences, when it comes. Araghchi is closer to the supreme leader of Iran. Zarif is pretending to be close, but when it comes to the policy, he's just getting far away from the supreme leader of Iran. This is the reality of what's going on. And the Pezeshkian, it's all happening within the administration in Iran. This is the total difficulties that we're witnessing with the administration is somehow a fraction, is also a fracture within the administration, within those people who are deciding about the foreign policy of Iran. You know, it's so much complicated, and many people don't understand what's going on with the new administration. At least with Raisi and his administration, it was totally somehow uniform. You had a foreign policy that anybody knew what's going on with it.
Coherent, straight to the point,
clearly
delimited. That's why it was such an effective administration. Yeah.
The reality in Iran is, But after all, Pepe, when you look at China today and compare it to what it was before, they're not shy. They're not timid anymore.
They changed completely. Wow. Yeah. Wow. It's the self-confidence of becoming an economic superpower and a technological superpower. This, my last trip to Shanghai, I was like, wow. You are hit in the face everywhere you look and everybody you talk to. I plan to go back. I'll be back this second semester. I'll be between Russia and China, more or less. And I want to get deeper. Absolutely. I want to go back to Xinjiang and look at Xinjiang from a technological point of view, which is nobody in the West has a clue about it, you know. So it's no wonder. It's no wonder. And talking to first-class Chinese academics, like we had the chance to do it during the summit in Rio, it's visible, you know, that the quality of the analysis is excellent, of course, and this sense of self-confidence. And yes, finally, China, we are not dictating, but we are not imposing, not dictating, but we are tracking our development and global international insertion the way we want, with no interference whatsoever. This is the sign of a sovereign power, a real sovereign power. Iran can do the same thing, Nima, but Iran, the constraints over Iran are much, much hardcore. And Iran is surrounded by the enemy. It's a different story. And Iran is not an economic superpower. It has, I would say, the potential. It's all there. When I was traveling the north-south economic corridor, you can feel it. You know, from the Caspian to the Persian Gulf, you can see, wow, you know, you can see the potential of the country, you know. But it's still a bit far compared to China. That's the difference. But at the same time, when you are in Iran, you feel that you are in a sovereign power. And the way Iran deals with all these challenges and so much pressure from all across the West, and they resist. It is extremely impressive. So maybe to wrap it all up, Brazil can learn a few lessons in terms of resistance from both China and Iran. And it's even better. They are sitting on the same table. It's a matter of picking up the phone.
Which we know how important is that when it comes to the way that you're dealing with sanctions, how Russia has learned from Iran to deal with sanctions.
Russia has learned everything about sanctions from Iran. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Muito obrigado, Pepe.
Muito obrigado a você, irmão. Always. Enorme prazer. But we didn't make it in Rio, but we make it on Zoom always.
Have a great time there, Pepe.
You too. Cheers. Bye-bye. See you soon. Bye-bye. Cheers. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Cheers.